Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, Claudia Bookman will explain why women are outperforming men academically and what it means. Obama proposes universal preschool, and conservatives predictably reject any measure that would improve women's lives. Also, a pregnant teen in Texas wins the right to give birth against her parents' wishes. Esther Perel gave a TED Talk addressing one of the biggest sexual conundrums of our time.
So what sustains desire, and why is it so difficult? And at the heart of sustaining desire in a committed relationship, I think, is the reconciliation of two fundamental human needs. On the one hand, our need for security, for predictability, for safety, for dependability, for reliability, for permanence, all these anchoring, grounding experiences of our lives that we call home. But we also have an equally strong need, men and women, for adventure, for novelty, for mystery, for risk, for danger, for the unknown, for the unexpected, surprise. You get the gist.
It's an interesting talk and surprisingly optimistic, despite the admitted problems with trying to reconcile domestic comfort and the need for novelty and passion. If you read right-wing media, you'll find that there's a constant drumbeat of panic over the fact that women aren't having what they believe is enough babies. It's obviously just a fig leaf for creating momentum behind restricting reproductive rights, but it's usually taboo to state this obvious observation openly. I'm not impressed, as you can tell, because it's crystal clear that people are having fewer children for economic reasons. They don't have enough time or money to raise kids, and contraception and abortion are simply the means to that end. If conservatives were sincere in their concerns about lowered birth rates, they'd be moving heaven and earth to make child-rearing more affordable. But instead, they oppose that every step of the way, especially if it means helping women achieve economic independence. Take, for instance, President Obama's suggestion during the State of the Union address that we institute universal preschool. This is a great idea because the research shows that it's good for kids. Researcher James Heckman explained on NPR.
And you put a number on it. Every dollar invested in early childhood development provides a 7 to 10% per annum return on investment. How does one get to those numbers, and how do we know that it's early childhood education to thank?
Well, actually, it's simple in this case. An experiment, the Perry study, a series of experiments were performed in which children, disadvantaged children primarily, were given enriched environments, pre-kindergarten environments, and some environments going back to the earliest years at birth. And what happened is the groups were randomly assigned, some to this enriched treatment and some control group. These people were followed into their adult lives. These children, originally sampled in the 1960s, they're now about 50 years of age. They've been followed in terms of their earnings, their criminal activity, measures of their health, education, attainment, and so forth. So we can actually compare what the return was to the people who got the treatment, the Perry study, and the control group who did not.
Now, it's true that they mostly focused on disadvantaged kids, and the return may not be so high for middle-class kids. But the return is so great for disadvantaged kids that even if there was no return on outcomes for middle-class kids, it would still put us in the black. But, as Heckman explains, a lot of it comes down to learning pro-social behaviors and self-control at a younger age, which will be beneficial for kids across classes. No matter, because no way will conservatives support this. The reason is that universal preschool makes it easier for women to hold full-time jobs, because it would save families a fortune in child care costs. But of course, the stated reasons are the usual incoherent nonsense, such as that which came out of Representative Marsha Blackburn's mouth.
I had an email from a teacher as they were giving the speech at someone I've known for a long time, and it was, "Are you kidding me? More paperwork." And I think so many of our educators, when they hear these programs coming from the federal government, they're just thinking, "Oh, that's another book of paperwork that I'm going to have to do." And teachers are so weighed down with that.
Representative Blackburn would have you believe that teachers would object to a huge influx of job opportunities teaching preschool because more paperwork. Okay, well, if they hate paperwork so much that they'd rather have fewer jobs on the market than fill it out, why not just quit the jobs they have now and live a life free of that confounded paperwork? Because they need the work, that's why. Of course, there was all the usual complaining that we can't afford to hire all these new teachers and build schools and whatnot, represented by Jerry Willis on Fox News.
I mean, no doubt about it. And I have to tell you, I think it's immoral to make all these promises when you know at the end of the day, you can't afford it. We can't afford it. To say preschool for everybody, are you kidding me? We don't have the money for that. He also promises mortgage assistance, $3,000 for everybody. This is just crazy talk. And I think it's immoral to put this across as something that's actually doable when it's not.
Meh, we can build a few fewer bombs this year or something. No, seriously, this is just deliberate economic ignorance. The truth of the matter is establishing universal preschool would be a huge economic boon. It would immediately create jobs for teachers and administrators, as well as those building the infrastructure. It would allow parents, mothers especially, to work more, which would contribute economically. And what's immoral is painting a program that we know saves us $7 for every dollar spent as something we can't afford. Stepping back, I'd say we can't afford not to do this. But it'll probably mean that fewer women choose to stay home with their kids or cut back on hours at work, which means that more women will be competing against men for plum jobs, which means conservatives will oppose it, even if it would help get up that birth rate they're always fussing about. I'd like to welcome Claudia Bookman to the program. Claudia is a professor of sociology at Ohio State University, and with her co-author, Thomas DePriet of Columbia, she has written a book called The Rise of Women, The Growing Gender Gap in Education and What It Means for American Schools, which looks at how women's gains in education have been influencing academia and the economy. Welcome to RealityCast, Claudia.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So, as you cover in your book, women have made tremendous gains in education, not just equaling, but outperforming men on the high school and college level, at least in the aggregate. Anti-feminists are in a panic about this, saying this is clearly the result of anti-male discrimination. But what's the real story here?
Well, there's definitely an important story here, and it is about both women's great progress and also stagnating male college, men getting their college degrees at stagnant rates. So in our book, we look at both sides of those issues. And of course, it's important to know that the many social changes in the opportunities for women in the labor force, the changing ideas about what women can accomplish, that is all a large part of the story about why women have really risen so rapidly to complete so many college degrees, to get more master's degrees and PhDs and professional degrees than ever before. So that's part of the story. The other really interesting story, part of the story, is that women have long gotten better grades than boys. So a lot of the fur that you're talking about over what's going on with our boys today, people don't realize that girls have gotten better grades than boys in school since the turn of the century. This is a really long-standing performance difference. And we go out of our way in the book to explain that, no, it doesn't have to do with girls being smarter than boys. What it really has to do with is advantages that girls have in terms of putting more effort into school and being more engaged in school. So it's what we need to clarify is that it's not that boys academically have been declining over time, but rather that their academic performance hasn't changed much. And this gap in academic performance, the fact that girls get better grades than boys, along with the real changing opportunities for women in our society, are what have led to that growing gender gap in getting college degrees. So that's a lot of the story.
So why don't boys perform better?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And we looked into that question carefully, and basically we completely disagree with the people, the commentators out there who are saying it's something about the way schools are treating boys or the feminization of schools. You know, schooling hasn't changed a whole lot over the last century either, in terms of the way school classrooms are structured and the like. So we think those arguments are really suspect. What we believe is behind some boys' poor academic achievement is really about kind of our pervasive norms of what it means to be a man in today's society. And while the roles for women have really expanded enormously, for at least some boys, we think that society is still sending them a message that, you know, what it means to be a man is to show your physical prowess, to, you know, excel in sports, and not necessarily to engage and put effort into school. And so we think it has to do with these sort of narrow ideas of masculinity that remain still pervasive in today's society that is holding boys back.
I've seen some feminists suggest that one of the reasons that women go to college more than men is that women need more education to compete with men on the job market to sort of make up for the discrimination that women face. Do you think that there's anything to that?
Well, I think there's something to that. I think that when, for any group that has been discriminated against in society, one strategy has been to try to get more education, to be able to, you know, because they aren't able to enjoy, you know, some of the benefits that privileged members of society have. But I would also say that, you know, another thing we have to remember is that the kinds of jobs that have been open to women for a longer period of time have been more typically jobs that require a college degree. So, and the fact that we still have a labor market where, you know, we have sort of female typical jobs and male typical jobs also means that women have a benefit from higher education, you know, being nurses and teachers and so on. Those are the jobs that used to only be open to women, but now as we've shifted in our economy to you know, a high knowledge information-based service economy with that service sector, high skill service sector really expanding, women, a lot of those jobs are the kinds of jobs that women look for. Now, while I say that, let me also emphasize that the challenge then is that men, young men, especially men growing up, you know, with blue collar fathers, maybe haven't gotten the message that the economy has really changed in important ways. With the decline of blue collar jobs, the kind of jobs that used to be really abundant and good jobs for primarily men, those jobs are really falling by the wayside. You know, construction, manufacturing, the skilled trades are declining. And in addition to that, unionized jobs in those sectors are declining. The power of unions has really decreased. So those jobs in those sectors, not only are they're dwindling in numbers, but they're also less likely to lead to a good, stable middle class living than they were before.
What's interesting to me is despite all that, and despite the fact that women are now more educated than men, women are still lagging in the job market. They're still making 76 cents to a man's dollar, 77 cents. Why are these educational gains not being reflected in the job market?
Well, I think the problem with making that kind of a grand statement is that we have to remember that there's just as much diversity across the women as there is between women and men. And so when you only look at sort of the average for all women and compare that to the average for all men, I think we miss some important variations that actually would temper that kind of claim. And let me give you a few examples. First of all, when we look at that wage gap, the gender wage gap, we're looking at all women of all age groups. And that the problem with that is that you've got women who are in their 50s and 60s in that age group, and you're lumping them together with women in their 20s and 30s. And when you look across these generations of women, we see that the wage gap for younger women who have a college degree compared to the male counterparts is smaller than that for older women. So I would argue that that is actually, you know, perhaps a glimmer of hope for the future. Now, by no means am I going to say that the gender gap is going to disappear anytime soon, and I don't have a crystal ball that can make that prediction. But I do think that there are women in some sectors and some age groups that are doing far better than that 78 cents to the dollar figure would indicate. Women are increasingly entering male-dominated professions like medicine, law, and business. And those are elite, prestigious professions, and in that regard, they're making great progress. Now, again, when we compare, you know, a woman in medicine to a man in medicine, there are often going to be gender gaps remaining in their wages. And that partly has to do with the kinds of jobs that women and men take. But I also think that to look at this point in history and say, you know, that the great gains in education are not going to lead to more progress for women in the labor market, I think that's short-sighted. I tend to be more optimistic and say that I think that over time we know that one of the biggest factors predicting income is the level of education one gets, and especially if one has a college degree or an advanced degree. And I believe that that will help women in the future close some of that gap. Some of the gap is due to other factors, like the fact that women and men tend to take different jobs in different fields, but some of the gap will close, I believe.
So, in closing, what would you suggest needs to be done to make it better for boys in school, improve young men's educational outcomes?
Well, I think that our research really shows that schools and parents, I would say, also families definitely have a role in this as well, that schools and parents need to set really high educational expectations. And schools need to be doing a much better job for helping students understand how their academic performance as early as middle school, but then, of course, in high school, really makes a difference for their likelihood to get a college degree. We have too many students out there with very high educational expectations. You know, 80% of young people today say they're going to get a college degree. But then their grades, the effort that they're putting into school, and then the grades as a result of that poor effort is closing those doors for them. And this is more a problem for boys than it is for girls. So I would say that's one thing. We need to do a better job of helping students understand how their academic efforts really, really matter for their future prospects. The other thing our research shows is that we should not be pursuing these kinds of boy-friendly school policies that people, anti-feminists, are advocating. Because all that does is serve to reinforce these kinds of traditional gender stereotypes that, you know, that aren't beneficial for girls or boys. What we need to be doing instead is creating strong academic climates that say boys and girls alike should pursue, anything that they're interested in. And ideally, they shouldn't be judged by either their peers or other people in terms of pursuing those interests. And so if we can create schools that have high expectations coupled with, getting away from these kinds of gendered notions about what do we need to do to get boys interested in school, I think actually we'll go a lot farther to providing, an educational system that's beneficial for boys and girls.
Awesome. My guest today has been Claudia Bookman. Her book, co-written with Thomas DePreet, is called The Rise of Women, The Growing Gender Gap in Education and What It Means for American Schools. You can buy it online or at your local bookstore. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Claudia.
Thank you. I got love for you if you were
born in the 80s. Anti-choicers are always going on and on with disingenuous claims that pro-choicers are just pro-abortion, and always trying to claim that we support the use of coercion and subterfuge to get unwilling women into abortion clinics. Their desperation to believe this is only equaled by the lack of evidence they have to support this contention. But they finally got lucky this month and found a 16-year-old who is desperate to have a baby and marry her 16-year-old boyfriend. And her parents sound like they were willing to do anything to stop them. The Texas Center for Defense of Life took up the case and sued the parents on behalf of the girl.
The lawsuit is 8 pages long and details alleged verbal abuse by the teen's parents. In the lawsuit, the teen claims her mom, quote, invited the paternal grandparents to a bar for further discussion, where she suggested she might slip her an abortion pill through deception. The teen also claims her father told her, quote, he was going to force her to have an abortion and that the decision was his. End of story.
Sounds terrible, it really does. Despite the fact that she went to the wrong people for help in securing her basic reproductive rights, I firmly support this girl and her lawsuit. The right to choose, contrary to anti-choice claims, really is just that, the right to choose. If a 16-year-old girl wants to have a baby, that is her choice, even if the rest of us believe it's a bad choice. As much as it may pain parents to hear it, teenagers have rights. And that includes the right to start making sexual and reproductive decisions for themselves. Her parents sound like idiots, too, making threats and talking about drugging her in secret, something that is harder than the mother probably guessed, since a good luck finding a doctor to cooperate. What's interesting is the girl's lawyer cited Roe versus Wade as precedent.
What Roe established in the cases after that was that a minor has an absolute right to make her choice. And what's revealing is a lot of times when people say, I do want to make the choice, folks are shocked when they want to choose to carry the baby in.
In other words, in an attempt to make pro-choicers look like hypocrites, anti-choicers revealed their own hypocrisy. Let's be clear. I think it's true that minors do have an absolute right to make a choice, but Texas law doesn't agree because anti-choicers have put parental notification laws in place. Antis claim these laws aren't a violation of Roe because they're supposed to involve parents in the decision. But as you can see from this lawyer's argument, they know damn well that parental notification laws violate a girl's right to choose. Hopefully, this lawyer made arguments that could be used as precedent to overturn parental notification, though I'm not holding my breath. The result of all this is that the girl not only won her case, but she super won it.
A court battle over abortion between a pregnant teen and her parents is over. The 16-year-old and her boyfriend made legal peace with her parents who wanted their daughter to have an abortion, but not before some drama inside and outside the courtroom when the pregnant girl's father attempted to strike a TV camera and made an obscene gesture. After meeting with a judge, though, both sides came to an understanding, the girl's parents promising not to interfere in her pregnancy and letting the couple get married.
The parents not only have to respect her right to choose and to marry under state law, but they also agree to support her by returning use of a car to her and even paying half her medical bills until she's married, which is just as well because the parents really need to be disabused of the notion that trying to control teenagers in this way works. If they did successfully coerce an abortion, and again, good luck finding a doctor who will do it over the patient's protests, she'd just go out and get pregnant again if that's what she's determined to do. I don't know the particulars of this case, but I will say, generally speaking, if you want to avoid having your teenage daughter show up pregnant and insisting she has to get married right now, the best prevention is to apply pro-choice principles from the beginning. If you discover your daughter is sexually active, trying to forbid her from seeing her boyfriend will likely backfire, causing the couple to believe they are star-crossed lovers who need to find a strategy to force you to accept their young love, often by having a baby and getting married. By accepting their relationship and even providing access to contraception to show your support, you will make it clear that they have all the time in the world to enjoy being young and in love without rushing into babies and marriage. If you respect her right to choose, the odds are high she'll make smarter, calmer, more rational choices. But the father in this case sounds like a domineering conservative type who believes that force is the only answer to his problems. And that belief appears to be biting him in the ass. And now for the wisdom of wingnuts. Rush Limbaugh gets his last sexist dig in on Hillary Clinton.
Well, what difference does it make now? You note that Ahmadinejad waited until Hillary left before he announced this. I mean, he's heard about her lockbox, a testicle lockbox.
Limbaugh lives in a world where if women have power, men cannot. In the beginning, this was evidence of his total lack of imagination, but now it just demonstrates he can't even open his eyes and see that men are continuing to hold powerful offices even as women are moving up the ranks. It is not, no matter how much he insists otherwise, a zero-sum game.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.